Okay, so welcome everybody to the Gravitation Wave seminar for December. Today we have Miriam speaking to us about machine learning and gravitational wave physics. So we're very happy to have her here today, and so let me just introduce her before we get started. So she did her bachelor's in physics in Spain at the University of Salamanca, and then did her master's and PhD in Max Planck Institute of Gravitational Wave Physics in Hanover, which is a very famous gravitational wave group, both experimentally and in data analysis. And at the time, she's been a member of the LIGO Scientific Collaboration from 2014 to 2019. And she did a postdoc at Princeton right immediately following her PhD. And now she's doing a postdoc in University of British Columbia in Vancouver, focusing a lot on gravitational waves and machine learning. And so with that, I give the floor to Miriam to talk to us about this very interesting topic.
Thank you, and thank you for having me here. So as Andrew mentioned, I'll be talking about GW Skynet. This is a new machine learning code that we have developed this year in view of the results from O3. So I maybe should mention, I am currently not in LIGO anymore, and I wasn't during O3. So whatever information I talk about regarding data from O3 is just public information. I know nothing about what happened behind the scenes. So here's an overview of the talk today. So I'm going to have a brief introduction about multi-messenger astronomy and the recent highlights just in general in the gravitational wave astronomy field. And I will go into a bit of motivation into why we wanted to develop this GW Skynet code, and hopefully you will understand what was the need for it after I give a bit of the motivation. And before diving into GW Skynet itself, I'm going to just mention some examples of machine learning codes in astronomy that have been successful or are looking very promising. There are also many codes in development, of course. And then I will just get into GW Skynet itself, the training set and the machine learning code and the results that we've had. And then I summarize in some future work. So as you all probably know, GW astronomy is a very recent field. So the detectors have been in construction for a few decades, but it's been in the last 5 years that we have started observing gravitational waves. So the first observing run, which was just with the two advanced LIGO observatories, this was for the second generation of ground-based detectors, was in 2015 and 2016. And almost immediately we had the first detection of gravitational waves. It was this beautiful binary black hole, remnant black hole of about 60 solar masses. The signal was unusually clear in because it was a loud signal, so not all the signals have been that clear to see by eye. But it was a very nice discovery for the beginning of the field. We had a couple more events in that observing run, and then it was finished the observing run to continue working on the detectors, because we are working, or now I should say they are working towards the design sensitivity that they're looking to achieve in this second generation. So between observing runs, there are improvements being made to detectors, and the sensitivity is improved. And then we had the second observing run at the end of 2016, going until the summer of 2017. It also started just with the two LIGOs in the US, but Virgo joined in August. So they were ready. They had achieved the sensitivity they wanted to achieve for joining the run. And they joined in August. And at the end, towards the end of the run, there had been several other events, but I just highlight GW17817, which was the first observation of gravitational waves from a neutron star merger, and also the first observation of a multi-messenger signature with telescopes. There was a follow-up of the event, and we could gain a lot of information from the kilonova about neutron star mergers. And then the third observing run was last year. It finished this year 1 month earlier than planned because of COVID. It was, from the beginning, was the two advanced LIGOs and advanced Virgo. So it was three detectors from the beginning, which has been giving more accurate sky localizations for many of the events. And in March this year, shortly before the end of the run, CAGRAB began observations. It's a milestone that they have joined so early because it's a completely new detector. It didn't exist in the first generation era, so it has been built recently. It has been built underground. They made the whole tunnels and everything, so it was very exciting time to have CAGRAB joining, and probably 404 they will be joining from the beginning if they can. And there have been many events in L3. As the sensitivity improves, we see more and more events. And just highlighting one of them, for example, is GW190521, which is so far the most massive black hole that we have seen in the stellar mass range, though some might consider this already an intermediate mass black hole. In the next slide, I have a summary of all the events that have been observed. This is not yet all of the O3 events. These are the events that have been published so far, which is for the first half of O3. That's the third observing run, and also for the first two observing runs. So they are classified in the y-axis by the mass in solar masses. So down here we have the neutron stars. The yellow ones are ones that we knew from electromagnetic astronomy, and these orange ones are the few binary neutron star and the neutron star black hole mergers observed by LIGO and Virgo. And at higher masses, we have the black holes. In blue are the black holes that we've seen through gravitational waves, and in purple are the ones that we knew about from electromagnetic astronomy. You can see that with the field of gravitational waves, we are uncovering a population of heavier stellar mass black holes that we had observed before just from electromagnetic radiation. And focusing a little bit on GW170817, mostly because this code is for multi-messenger astronomy. So this was a great milestone in the field of multi-messenger astronomy. We had this binary neutron star that we observed first in gravitational waves while the neutron stars were still far apart and in spiraling each other. So the gravitational wave signature was very long in our detectors. It lasted over 100 seconds. And then once the binary neutron stars were merging and we have the end of the gravitational wave, then we started observing the electromagnetic signature. So there was some matter being expelled, and of course all of what's happening here depends on the equation of state of the neutron stars, which we still don't know exactly what it is. But this is like from a particular simulation. Like you can see how matter is starting to be disrupted, and there's a whole lot of things happening afterwards when the two neutron stars have merged and have collapsed into a black hole, but there's still all this matter around, and this is the whole kilonova signature that could be observed for months after the gravitational wave event. So the two main ingredients for a successful follow-up campaign is that we need to have an accurate sky localization so that telescopes can point at the sky location and can potentially observe a counterpart. And we also need the rapid release of information. If astronomers don't know about the gravitational wave, then they cannot look for the counterpart. So in O2, the second observing run, the information about gravitational wave candidates was released to partner astronomers. So there was an agreement between the LIGO and Virgo collaborations and the partner astronomers, and they will receive the information. And here's, for example, the sky location for GW170817 as calculated by different detectors. So we observe first the gravitational wave. Just the sky localization as measured by the two LIGO detectors are these two green contours, light green contours. And as you added the data from Virgo, you see that the sky localization gets much, much smaller, much more accurate. And then 2 seconds after the event, the gravitational wave event, there was a gamma ray that was observed. And these two blue contours are like the sky localization estimated from the gamma ray for the two different detectors that observed it. And then here's a bit more of a complicated figure, which I won't go into much detail. You might, some of you might have seen it many times. But mainly in the x-axis, we have just the time that passed after the gravitational wave event. So at zero is the coalescence of the two binary neutron stars as observed by the gravitational wave. And then in the y-axis, we have like the different parts of the electromagnetic spectrum. So we can see the gamma ray was observed almost immediately, like 2 seconds after the event. And then almost one day later, if I remember correctly, this was during daytime for many of the telescope observatories, so they had to wait until nighttime, and at nighttime then they started observing within this region, and in the optical spectrum they found a counterpart which was not there before this gravitational wave event, and there was strong evidence that this signature came from the binary neutron star merger. So thanks to this little dot, we were able to pinpoint the host galaxy of the merger, which is NGC 4993. This means that we had the exact sky location and the distance with some small uncertainty, of course, but we knew the sky location and distance, and that allowed for much more accurate analysis of the gravitational wave itself. So we learned a lot about equations of state. We made our first measurements with gravitational waves of the Hubble constant. The error bars are still relatively wide, but as we get more events like these, where we can observe a counterpart and distinguish the host galaxy, then we'll be able to add this information to the events that we already know, and we'll be able to get this kind of information much more accurate. So in the third observing run, this gravitational wave candidate alerts, they became public. So you didn't need to have an agreement with the collaboration anymore to have access to this information. It was released in what's been called these open public alerts. And again, what I'm going to be talking from now on is just information from outside the collaboration. So the original alert is sent automatically. So the search pipelines find a gravitational wave signal, and then this is sent to the base star pipeline, which calculates the sky localization. There's some automated vetting, just looking at some points in the data to make sure it's not just like a computer glitch or something like that. And then automatically this preliminary alert gets sent out. After this alert is sent, this is within minutes of detection, then a group of experts within LIGO and Virgo get together into a teleconference, and they look at the results from the search pipeline, they look at the initial parameter estimation results, and they look at the data, and they look at the detectors, and they look at all the information that they have to try to figure out if there was something in the data, some noise artifact in the data that could explain this trigger, this gravitational candidate trigger. And if everything looks fine, then they just send an initial alert, which is more like, okay, we have confirmed things are fine, here's a bit more information. Or if things were not fine, then they send a retraction. And this can, towards the end of the run, this will take about 5 minutes, but it also took like some learning process. Whenever you start a new observing run, you have new data that you haven't seen before. So at the beginning of the run, some retractions could take hours or maybe even days. And then throughout the course of the run, you know, they're constantly reanalyzing the data as more data is coming in, the parameter estimation pipelines, which take a long time to finish, they might be getting more accurate results. So if the results change significantly with respect to the initial alert, then they send updates. So the main takeaways from this slide are that the automated open public alerts appear within minutes of detection, and human vetting could lead to retraction of candidates, which sometimes take minutes or can take hours or days. So this is the information that we have in the OPAs. So the group tells you if it comes from the model searches, which is the CBC, or if it's from unmodeled searches, then it says burst. This is just a particular example, O3. The pipeline for the model searches, there are four different pipelines. In these examples, this was GST-Lab. There are, I believe all of them are all sky searches. In the instruments, it will tell you which detectors were observing at that time. So it could be just two of them, or it could be all three of them. And then you have the event time. You have the sky localization, which is computed by BayStar. So 3D sky maps, where you have here the 2D sky map probability with the 50 and 90% regions of higher probability. And you have here the volume. So from the distance and these volume probabilities, you can kind of get from your galaxy catalogs which galaxies are contained within this volume, and then do targeted searches. That's what some of the telescopes do for EM follow-up. We have also the classification. On one hand, we have this Hess neutron star or Hess remnant classification. So the first one just means there is a neutron star in the binary. So this will be yes for binary neutron stars and neutron star black holes. And the Hess remnant means there's expected that after the coalescence, there's some matter, some remnant matter that could generate electromagnetic counterparts. So this is generally yes for binary neutron stars. And for neutron star black holes, it will depend on the mass ratio if there is remnant matter or not. If the black hole is very heavy, then it will just swallow the neutron star without disrupting it, and you won't have remnant matter. So these are expressed as probabilities. They don't just say yes or no. This example, because it was a binary neutron star candidate, it got 100% for both having neutron star and having remnant. And then there's this other classification in these five different categories. There are these three categories that correspond to types of binaries. And then there's the terrestrial category that will indicate it's likely not astrophysical and rather a noise source. So in this example, there's a 37% probability of being terrestrial, but 63% of being a binary neutron star. And I just have here this plot, this which is the mass one and mass two of the binaries. This just indicates what the different binary types are classified as. So the mass gap are events where at least one of the objects has a mass between 3 and 5 solar masses. That means the other one can be a neutron star. So sometimes mass gap, even if it says 0% NSBH, mass gap could still be an NSBH, because it mainly just it's mainly just categorizing in terms of this 3 to 5 solar mass component. So at the end of O3, I focus here just on the candidates from the model searches. There are also three candidates from the unmodeled searches, two of which were retracted. But from the model searches, we had 77 candidates in O3. 22 of them were retracted, and of the remaining 55 candidates, this is the classification. So most of them were binary black holes. We have a few of 14 events that may or may not have had a neutron star final results were published later, and some of them we still don't know. This one, it has a question mark. So here I'm indicating what's the highest category. The category has more than 50% probability. In the case of this one event, it's not clear. None of the categories had more than 50% probability. So it's all, it's sort of like 40, 30, 20, and it's just hard to tell what it is. And then there are three that had a higher than 50% probability of being of terrestrial origin, but they had not been retracted, which means there was no obvious issuing the data. So this is just as estimated by their algorithms. So now I'm going to go into a bit more details or examples on some of the candidates and retracted candidates, and this will be as a motivation for why we started working on this GW SkyNet code. So here are some retraction examples, and I focused on some that will be of interest for electromagnetic follow-up. So we have, for example, these which had a high probability of being a binary neutron star. The false alarm rate is not bad, 1 per 80 years. And it was estimated to be at a distance of 166 megaparsecs, which is like 4 times farther away than GW170817, but it's still not excessively far, let's say. So after the initial alert, the first follow-up, electromagnetic follow-up, was started 13 minutes later, and then 32 minutes after the initial alert, there was a retraction. So I don't have here how many follow-ups happened in between. I just wanted to emphasize that some follow-ups were started before the event was retracted. Here's a mass gap event that, as I said, could potentially be a neutron star black hole. So often astronomers will also follow up mass gap events. It had an even better false alarm rate, 1 per 1,000 years. It was a bit farther away than the other example, but the sky localization was more accurate. So here we had, it's hard to read, but here we had 580 square degrees in the 50% contour. Here we just had 122. So it would have been easier to follow up than this other one. And the first follow-up started 10 minutes after the initial alert, but then 14 minutes later, it was retracted. And just for having a different one, and a one neutron star black hole, great false alarm rate. It was very close, 31 megaparsecs. So that's even closer than GW170817. The sky localization is very well localized, so just 46 square degrees in the 50% contour. So this is a great candidate for EM follow-up. And the first follow-up started 85 seconds later. And these are automated follow-ups, which is why they're started so quickly. And the retraction came 19 minutes later. So of course, how many follow-ups happen in between will also depend if your telescopes are in nighttime or daytime. Like if you are using a telescope that is in Chile and at that moment it's daytime in Chile, you have to wait until night. But if it's already night, then you can start following up immediately. And here's an example, the one I know of for which the LIGO and Virgo collaborations put out some additional information into showing why this event was retracted. And you can see that there's an obvious loud glitch in the data at the Hanford detector. And they found evidence that this glitch was the cause for this trigger. And hence it was retracted. And here's just the GCN circular of the retraction of this candidate, where they said that the data in LIGO Hanford was highly non-stationary, which you can see here. And there were some slides about it. There's more information in this document, which is in the public documents of the LIGO DCC. But then there are also many candidate examples that were not retracted, but the algorithms are saying that they have a very high probability of being of terrestrial origin. So I have three examples here. This one is 97% probability of being of terrestrial origin, and it has a false alarm rate of 24 per year. There's still follow-ups that happened. 1.5 hours after the initial event, alert was the first follow-up. And it has not been retracted, and this is from the second half of 03, so these results have not been published yet, so we still don't know if this event is real or not. There's another example, it's also very high probability of terrestrial origin, a bit better false alarm rate, is 1 per year. The first follow-up started 25 minutes later. This one is from the first half of 03, so this one has already been published. So we do know this one is I think not real. We'll see that later. And here's another example, and I'm going to talk about this a little bit more because this one is interesting. So it's just 58% probability of terrestrial origin, so it's not as bad as the other two. False alarm rate 1 per 3.6 years, and there were even papers about the follow-up of this event. I'm going to talk about one of them. So what's interesting about this event, like, it wasn't retracted, but it it got several updates. So the initial alert was saying that it had a 98% probability of being a binary neutron star and a false alarm rate of 1 per 37 years. So it was initially more significant than after the updates. So this made it a good candidate for EM follow-up. And because it was classified as a BNS, some astronomers decided to follow it up. There was an update later that day, like half a day later, which reduced a little bit the probability of being from a binary neutron star, but it was still high enough to motivate the electromagnetic follow-up. And then 1.5 days after the initial alert, there was a new update. The false alarm rate went down and the BNS probability went under 50%. So there was a higher probability now for this candidate being terrestrial. So there's this paper that was published some time after the event where these astronomers had started a two-night observation campaign, and it was motivated because the event was initially classified as a binary neutron star with 98% probability. So they did identify some transients. They identified and publicly announced 13 candidate counterparts. It was later noticed that there are more likely supernova events than counterparts to this particular event. It's still interesting that they found 13 new candidates, but they were not related to this candidate event. And the updates to these events, they were coming during the observation campaign. So when they started the observation campaign, it was still likely a BNS. And then at the end of their observations, the problem was when this update came that the false alarm rate got worse and the probability classifications were favoring a terrestrial classification. So by the time they got this information, they had already finished their electromagnetic follow-up. And in fact, between the first and second nights, there was an update on the sky map. So this is their first night. This was the preliminary sky localization from Baystar. And they had to focus on this region here because this region was already, as it says here, it was already below the horizon in Chile where they were using the telescope. So they couldn't observe this in the first night. They focused on this area here. And then when there was an update, they find, oh, this area is not really there anymore. There's just this little region left and it doesn't have a very high probability. So now this is the region with highest probability. So most of the follow-up they had done the previous night was not applicable to this event. So then the second night they focused on this region. So these are the kind of examples that I want to use. That these are a motivation for developing GW SkyNet. So not always, there's not always an obvious reason, an obvious noise glitch that will lead LIGO and Virgo to retract a candidate. So there are many candidate examples that were never retracted, and when the results were published, turned out to be not real. So there will be telescope resources invested on these candidates if they are believed to be binary neutron stars or if they have good sky localizations. So the motivation for developing GW SkyNet was, is there something that we can do outside of LIGO Virgo? Can we use the data that they are giving us and try to do something with that data to try to decide if these candidates are real? Especially as the sensitivity improves, there'll be more and more events. So it'll be more and more difficult to just retract all of the noise events, and it'll be more and more difficult to follow up all the events. There won't be enough resources. Different groups, they might just get a particular amount of time to spend on the telescopes. So this was the motivation for GW SkyNet. And before going into this, just very quickly, I want to mention some examples of machine learning in astronomy. We have, for example, Gravity Spy. It's a machine learning code that is used for glitch classification. So there are many different types of glitches in LIGO and Virgo data. There are some examples here in this figure in the right. And what Gravity Spy does, it uses also human inputs to create the training set. So they have a citizen science project in Zooniverse. You get like different levels as you advance. You can classify more and more glitches. And the more and more glitches you classify, the higher your ranking is. And the information from there is used to label glitches for the training set that is then used for the machine learning classifier. And then the machine learning classifier can tell you the data you have for the training, the more accurate it is becoming, and it can tell you the types of glitches. This is very useful to identify the sources of the glitches. So once you have the data from the classifier, you can try to track down. Some glitches are still unknown, unresolved. It's not known what causes them, but many glitches, the cause has been identified, and once the cause is identified, it's easier to try to mitigate them. And I say try because it's not always easy to mitigate them. Another example, which Andrew is an author on this, so he has worked on this machine learning code. This is the code that has been used for giving the classification of has neutron star or has remnant, which I was mentioning from the OPAs. So the labels are that has neutron star or has remnant, and they come from the initial parameters. The training set is a large set of simulated signals, and from the parameters of the signals, they get the labels. But then the search pipeline identifies the signals with different parameters because of the discrete nature of the template bank. You don't have all the parameters covered in your search. So the recovered parameters are used as the features for training the machine learning algorithm. And I think I'm not going to go too much into this because I want to have time to talk about GW Skynet, but here's like the performance of their machine learning code and how it changes as you change your threshold between true or false or yes or no. Also just brief mention, there are machine learning efforts for detecting gravitational waves. There was a lot of work for binary black holes in the past. Binary black holes are easier because they're shorter, so you don't need that much data. There are more efforts now on binary neutron stars. And these are just some examples of two different machine learning efforts that use a different input and also different architecture in their machine learning code. And this is one of the cases in which these codes look promising, but they are not being fully used yet. They're still in development. And there's still some work to do before they reach the same accuracy as match filtering searches at the same computational cost. And here is one which is in electromagnetic astronomy, which is from one of my collaborators in the GW Skynet. He also worked on this code. So in here you have like the images. That's like you're observing tonight and you get this image and you have the same image from that same galaxy from 2 weeks ago. So that's your reference image, and then you subtract them. And if there's a difference, then that's a potential transient candidate. This is often used for electromagnetic counterpart follow-up. So these are some examples of real events, and these are some examples of what they call bogus events, which is just like the subtraction is done badly or there's an artifact. So these are not real astrophysical counterparts. It's just from the subtraction algorithm. So they use these to train. So they label many examples of this to train the machine learning code. This is the convolutional neural network. And now they can use these to potentially extract which are the real astrophysical events from their data. So now into GW Skynet. So as I mentioned, the motivation is, can we use the public data to distinguish, to provide additional information? Is this source likely to be real or not, especially when there is not a retraction? So we used the convolutional network on the sky maps that are released with the OPAs. So this is from now on, I'm going to be talking mainly about this paper. So for the training set, we needed a set of real events and a set of noise events. So for the real events, we didn't have enough real astrophysical signals because the field of gravitational astronomy just started like 5 years ago. So we just had two handfuls of signals. Now with O3A, there are more, but it's still less than 50. So it's not enough for creating a real set. So we also use simulated signals with waveform models as predicted from GR. So for neutron stars, we use masses between 1.2 and 2.2 solar masses and a smaller spin. And for black holes, we used masses up to 100 solar masses and higher spins. And we generated binary neutron stars, neutron star black holes, and binary black holes. We injected these simulated signals into fake Gaussian noise, and we used fake noise because we wanted to avoid noise events. We wanted to have a clean, real set. So we used different sensitivities from what was available at that time, was mainly O1 and O2. So we used the power spectral densities from these three events. Here's an image of the last one. This was the one that we used to incorporate Virgo to our data. So here's the frequency and the power spectral density, and you see the lower the better. So Livingston is the most sensitive of the three at this time. Hanford had been affected with respect to the rest of the observing run because of an earthquake that they didn't recover from, which is also why we separated this into two. And we ended up with almost 3,000 examples. This is easy to increase, it's easy to add more, but we wanted to see first how many noise events we could find because you want to have a balanced training set. And we use this condition just to mimic what the search pipelines do. So for each detector, or for at least two detectors, you need to have signal-to-noise ratio greater than 4.5, and then the network SNR, which is just the square root of the squared sum of the individual SNRs that had to be greater than 7. We use that same condition for the noise set. And for the noise set, so I talked a bit about Gravity Spy. So we had a set of glitches, noise glitches from Gravity Spy. So we got that information from the Gravity Spy team for O1 and O2, which was the data that was public. And we also needed triggers from the search pipeline. So we used these two open gravitational wave catalog, which is published by the PiCBC group. The PiCBC is one of the pipelines that is also used by LIGO and Virgo. And they had published all of their triggers. So they have this GitHub page where you can find all of their triggers. So we use that, and we're trying to find triggers that will coincide with the time of a glitch, so that kind of will be obvious that the trigger was caused by the glitch. And so we were looking for time coincidence. And for the examples that we found, we plotted them. Here we have a time frequency representation of the data. The normalized power of the data is showing you like the glitch here in the middle. This is a blip glitch. And this red line is the waveform template from the search. This was the one that triggered. It had an SNR greater than our conditions. So this was one example that we used as candidate for the training set. So for each of our, I didn't mention we had like 1,300 examples. So that's why then we didn't add more simulated signals, because we didn't want to decrease the balance, to worsen the balance. So for each example, we then generated the sky maps, not just the 2D sky map, but the full 3D sky map, as I was showing earlier. We used the base star code, which is the same code used by LIGO and Virgo. This gives you a flexible image transport system file, which is a FIS file that contains the information about the sky map and a few more metadata that we ended up using too. We had some pre-processing, so we convert the sky map into a rectangular projection. We also downsample, because this was going to be done by the machine learning code anyway, so we just did it beforehand to reduce the number of computations during training. So from 360 to 180, we went down to 180 by 90. And we used this sky map image, the three stacked volume images, the posterior mean distance, the detector network, which will be important to know if this was two detectors or three detectors, and which detectors also. And then all of this data is normalized, and then we also use the normalization factor as training features. So this is the architecture of GW SkyNet. These are several different, just so it's a non-sequential convolutional neural network. Each branch accepts a different type of data, and then all of it is put together, it's concatenated together to get the final output. So the first, these two branches are the convolutional neural networks for the image data. So here's where we input the SkyMap image and the volume images. And I'm not going to go into detail of this because I want to focus more on the results. And these are, these branches are a bit simpler. We don't need convolutional neural networks for the numerical and categorical data. We just need a simple layer of neutrons for the detectors, the distance, and the normalization factors. So there are four of these. So we have here 6, 8 branches. So we had reserved some of our training set for testing, like 10% for testing. So this is the performance on the test set. By choosing a particular real-to-noise threshold, this means that if the machine learning code will return a probability, if that's greater than 0.5 or 50%, then we call it a real event. And if it's less than 50%, then we call it a noise event. In the paper, we have also results for different thresholds, but I won't talk about it here. So we have here the confusion matrix. You have the true label here, so it's either a real or a noise event, and the predicted label if it's noise or real. So if it's a real and you predict noise, that's a false negative, or if it's noise and you predict real, that's a false positive. And then the diagonal are the true negatives and the true positives. So in parentheses is the fraction, so the percentage. So from these numbers, you can get these performance metrics. The accuracy tells you how often is your model correct, independently of what the true and predicted label are, just in general, how often is your model correct. So you measure that in terms of the total number of predictions. But then you also have the precision, which tells you how often the model is correct when you predict that the candidate is real. So if you're predicting real, how often are you being right in terms of all the predicted positives that you have? And more important for us, I think, is the recall. How many real candidates are predicted correctly? I think this is more important from us, because if we label a noise event as real, it's not that bad. That just means we haven't provided any additional information that LIGO and Virgo didn't tell us already. But if we label a real event as noise, and then that will be more problematic, especially if that induces astronomers not to follow up this candidate. And it turns out it really is astrophysical and they could have found a counterpart. That's what we don't want to happen. So on the test set, these are the values that we got for these three metrics. So the recall is not as great as the precision and the accuracy. But I'm going to show now results on the GRACE-DB event. So we use the GRACE-DB events also as a test. And the recall we got here was a bit better. So here in this slide is before GWTC2 was published. So we still didn't know. There's still these 51 candidates that we didn't know about. There were 4 gravitational waves that had been published, and for all of those 4, we predicted that they're all real, so that was a good result. For the 22 retracted events, we predicted more than half that were real instead of noise. So this is wrong. This should have been 22 noise. We think we know why this happened. We have some limitations in our training set. One is that we only had triggers from the PyCVC pipeline. Most of the retracted events came from the GSTLL pipeline. And we also didn't have much Virgo data because we only had that one last month from O2. And many of the retracted events included Virgo data. So we believe that if we can add other pipelines, and after O3 is published and we can add more Virgo data, then we might get better results here. Then in terms of the non-published candidates, it predicted that 41 were real and 10 were noise. At that point, we didn't know what was the answer. So we published these results without knowing. And just these are the 10 events. You can also find these in the paper. These are the 10 candidates that we predicted to be not real. And then shortly after we published our paper, the GWTC2 catalog came out. So it has the results between the 1st of April and the 1st of October of 2019. So it's the first half of the O3 run. So 29 of the non-retracted and unpublished candidates are contained in this period. And of those 29, the LIGO-Virgo results say that 22 are astrophysical and 7, they did not survive the low, the high latency pipeline. So there are 7 that turned out to be noise. Of those, we had predicted 6 to be noise. So there was just one misclassification, which is a noise event was identified as real. So that's not the worst case scenario. The other way around will have been worse, but it was nice to see that for this particular subset, our recall was 100%. All the real events were classified as real. And almost all the noise events were classified as noise. We just missed one. So there are these 6 events that if GW Skynet will have been running already by O3, maybe this information could have saved some electromagnetic follow-ups. Like, for example, the one we were talking about earlier, this 1905-10G candidate, where they had the 2-night observation campaign. GW Skynet predicted that this candidate is a noise event. So if we will have had this information back then, maybe it could have saved this 2-night observation campaign if astronomers had taken the information from GW Skynet. And there's this other paper where they had the follow-ups for the 13 binary neutron star and neutron star black hole candidates from O3. So I just separated here. The top ones are the O3A events, which now have been published, and the O3B events. So of all the candidates they followed up, we predicted 4 of them as noise, and these were later turned out to be noise as GWTC2 was published. This one was also turned out to be noise, but this is the one that we made in Skynet. And then for O3B results, we still don't know, but GW Skynet predicts that these 2 are noise. They, if they do turn out to be noise, then that will be 2 additional candidates for which our results could have saved the invested telescope time and person power. And you can see, for example, here in parentheses, this is the probability of terrestrial origin as given by LIGO Virgo. And you can see that generally it's not necessarily very high. For example, this one is just 2%. This one is 14%. So just from this information, you wouldn't necessarily decide not to follow up this candidate just because of this 2% or 7%. So this is where we believe that GW Skynet can help. And I'm going to finish with that. So main takeaways. Not all noise events are retracted immediately or even at all. So it will take months or a bit longer to get the final results from LIGO Virgo. And until then, you won't know if the unpublished non-retracted candidates are real or not. So there will have been telescope resources and person power invested on those candidates, especially if LIGO Virgo tells that they have a high probability of containing a neutron star. And it might turn out that often those candidates are noise events. GW Skynet uses the public data just as to complement the information that we get from LIGO and Virgo. It's of course up to every astronomer to decide if they want to follow up a candidate or not based on what LIGO, Virgo, and GW Skynet tell us. But when we get to that stage in which astronomers have to decide which candidates to follow up, especially because there are so many of them, then GW Skynet could be an additional source of information to help with that decision. And our current model is publicly available in this GitHub. So there's a notebook there that you can select particular candidate from GraceDB, and it will download the fits file and run the machine learning algorithm and tell you the prediction. And these are the predictions that we have in the paper. And just some future work things that I kind of mentioned, we have to incorporate O3 data and other pipelines in our training set to better measure the retracted events. We want to use the new astrophysical population that was released from GWTC2 to generate our simulated signals. We need to have a more astrophysically motivated set of real events. We're also working on some architectural changes. We're testing graph neural networks. These are mainly students in other institutions are working on this, to making the classifier a multi-class classifier, so it could also give you probabilities into different types of binaries, kind of like what LIGO does. It will tell you if it's a BNS or an SPH or BBH, and also adding additional features like there are these base factors in the FITS files that we didn't use now, but it could improve results. Tentatively didn't change much, but it might make it work better or faster or require less additional data. And then also interpretability and have automated GWs kind of results for O4. That will be our more long-term goal, so we don't need to have that ready until O4 starts. And I'll finish there and take any questions, if any, and thank you all for listening. I know it's an unusual time, so thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, Miriam, for the nice talk. Are there any questions for Miriam about what she's talked about to us today? Maybe I can ask one. I was wondering, how does the noise influence the ability of the network to classify noise or real or not? Is there a direct influence or?
So it is not clear if different types of glitches will have a different imprint. So at the beginning of this project, I was a bit skeptical that it was going to work because I was not quite sure that the sky map will have enough information about the data itself being real or not. And I thought if it were so obvious, then humans will have noticed. But of course, machine learning codes see things that we don't see. And because this is just a binary classifier now, so initially we're just saying real or noise, we don't know if there will have been a difference between different types of noise. I think it will depend more on which type of, maybe on the duration of the glitch, like which type of template it is that triggered with the glitch. So for example, I can imagine that if there are like long BNS templates that are triggering because of scattering glitches that take several seconds, then the imprint that it leaves on the sky map might be different than if it's a short binary black hole template that triggered with a blip glitch. But in terms of multi-class classifier, I think we want to focus more on having several classes for the real candidates and not so much for the noise candidates, because at the end of the day, for electromagnetic follow-up, it doesn't really matter that much the type of noise that triggered the event. You just need to know that it's noise. And it might not always be obvious glitches, because if there were very obvious glitches, then the candidate might have been retracted. So it's a bit hard to tell.
Yeah, I think it's a hard problem. But does anybody else have questions?
And I talk for a long time, so maybe I accept many things.
Yeah, they all understand perfectly. But maybe I have another one. I was wondering how does LIGO calculate this probability of terrestrial versus astrophysical? Because it seems it's very flawed, whatever it is.
So it's based on the results from the search pipeline directly. So I don't know exactly. I don't think it's a machine learning code like the neutron star and remnant classification. It's more like they use Poisson statistics and they use like results from the search pipeline to just see. I think it's mainly like seeing at what the templates in the search are. So it'll be kind of like based on the recovered parameters. They look also a campaign of simulated signals, and based on the recovered parameters, they kind of extract the information of the initial the simulated signal. No, I am not 100% on the details. I know I could tell you which paper to look into, but that's the more, I just have this more general view that it's based on the search pipeline results.
Yeah, okay, thanks. Are there any other questions for Miriam? I guess not, but so, okay, Giacomo says very clear.
Thank you.
So good, thank you for the talk, Miriam. It was very interesting.
And thank you for having me.
Of course, yeah. So bye for now and for the rest.
Thank you very much.
Yes,
thanks. Thank you. Enjoy your evening.
Yeah, you too. Have a nice day.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye-bye, nice seminar.
Bye.